Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and it's great to have Baroness Carolyn Cox at the Sydney Institute. Firstly, I should thank Roger Chilton and David Panter of Heart Australasia. Heart, of course, is the Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, for making this function possible tonight. And now to our speaker, Baroness Cox has a background in nursing and as an academic, but she was appointed to the House of Lords in 1982 and was Deputy Speaker of the House of Lords for some 20 years. She was, of course, an appointment of the Margaret Thatcher government and now sits on the crossbenches in the House of Lords. And today, Baroness Cox, who's also a published author, is going to speak for us on the topic of the privilege of making a difference. Carolyn Cox, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. But I was so much out of that world that when you become a baroness, you can get appointed to the House of Lords, like your Senate. But I was so much out of that world that I was the first baroness I ever met. So, you had my chance to join the club. But of course, it is a very great privilege to be able to speak in one of the houses on the British Parliament for people who cannot speak for themselves. That I do cherish, whether as a nurse on behalf of vulnerable people in our own society, but increasingly on behalf of forgotten peoples in forgotten lands. And I established Heart about 6 years ago, having done quite a lot of work with people who were often trapped behind closed borders, who were off the radar screen, and not being reached by major aid organisations. So Heart was established by both aid and advocacy. We're not just another aid organisation. There are good aid organisations out there. But aid and advocacy for people suffering oppression and persecution, largely affected by the international aid organisations. Now that situation develops because the big aid organisations, the names you would all know, like the UN, the Red Cross, can only go places with the permission of a sovereign government. The sovereign government denies them access to victims within their own borders, then they cannot go. You saw that with Cyclone Nargis in Burma a little way back, when many people were suffering from that cyclone, and the regime did not give permission to the UN and the big aid organisations to reach the victims, so many died. Means we do spend quite a lot of our time crossing borders illegally and quite shamelessly, because we believe that we do have a mandate to try to reach those people who are trapped and largely unreached for political or security reasons by the major aid organisations. Our mission, as I said, is to provide appropriate aid to those who have recently been suffering oppression and persecution. We're not an emergency relief organisation. I happen to be a founder of Merlin, Medical Emergency Relief International, which is the British equivalent of Medicine Sans Frontières, a big player in the world of international emergency relief. We're too small to make a difference there. So our focus is on victims of violations of human rights. And very briefly, our principles, the four interrelated aids. Authenticity. I believe passionately in the importance of going in person to be with these people trapped behind those borders off the radar screen for two reasons. One, to underpin aid. These people may be living displaced in the jungle, out in the remote areas of southern Sudan with nothing. So important to go and ask them their priorities. In Sudan, just a few months ago, one of the local leaders said, why do so many aid organisations just tell us what they're going to do? Why don't they ask? We believe in giving them the dignity of choice. So we ask them their priorities, for that you've got to be there. But also you've got to be there to underpin the advocacy. To be able to come back and say, I've been, I've seen, this is how it really is. But when I do speak in the House, I know the House listens, because I'm not just reading a Reuters press report. I've come back, and the House will often say, use our strange terminology, the noble baroness brings information to Reuters House, which we couldn't have in any other way. What a privilege. And that underpins the fourth A, the accountability. Primarily accountable to those with whom we speak, that our message is authentic and accurate, but also accountable to those who support our work. They know what we've done, what they made possible. and I'm passionate about this. And I'd like to see the whole aid paradigm in developing countries move much more in this direction of working with local partners, not really expat teams on the ground. You need those in the big crises, but the development work, partners. What a privilege to work with local partners, and so many advantages. It maintains their dignity, as I've said. You ask people, you don't tell them. It avoids upsetting the local economy. Very often, in these big UN organisations go in with large salaries, they often upset the local economy, they put local subsistence farmers out of business. But if you work with local partners, then you're not going to have that dislocating effect. It avoids independency. We give a helping hand, not a handout. It enhances, doesn't diminish, local leadership and authority relationships. We get alongside local people, don't move them on the side. We work through them, and that enhances their position in the local community, and what I love, enables us to celebrate their achievements, and enables them to take pride in them. That enhances sustainability to a soul. So you won't see a heart clinic, we may pay for it. Never be a heart, it'd be their clinic. Now, if you will put the seatbelts on, we're going to start our travels. Burma, I don't call it Myanmar, because the local people hate the name Myanmar. It was inflicted upon them. You'll be aware that there is a very brutal military junta with a lovely name. SPDC stands for State Peace and Development Council. George Orwell could not have done that. It is a brutal military regime. It carries out crimes against humanity, which is internationally condemned. And what it calls, as far as its ethnic nationals are concerned, people like the Karen, the Shan, what it calls a counter-insurgency strategy, but that contravenes international humanitarian law in so many ways. The catalogue of human rights violations includes military offences against its own civilians, forced labour, rape as a weapon of war, extrajudicial killings, torture, and attempted ethnic cleansing of so many of those ethnic nationals, which comprise 40% of the population of Burma. Come with us as we begin our travels in Shan State, up on the northern side of the eastern border of Burma, with Thailand and the other countries adjoining. Exiles in their own land. Come with us as we travel illegally from Thailand into Shan State. We're a long way up the river on the longboats, and it's so beautiful. You can't have been exhilarated, but you know you're going into a heart of darkness. Walking inside Shan State, just before we came to the camp where we were going to visit, I just saw this girl standing there, looking wistfully over that beautiful landscape. It's not her home. She's an exile in her own land. The camps, where they've been driven off their land, having to live in these refugee camps. But it's so important, when you go in, to help children, to have a little bit of a childhood. So we'll always take things like musical instruments, sports equipment, because they are exiled in their own land, their quality of life is so diminished and demeaned, but if they give them music, they're so thrilled with that and they're talented. You give them sports equipment, at least it gives them a little bit of childhood. The conditions are pretty dark among the refugee camps inside Charles State, where people are being driven off by SPDC military offences off their own land. Bedtime, pretty pathetic, bath time. But they maintain a dignity. One of the things that always humbles us is however poor and desperate and destitute, people retain their dignity. This is their makeup, their cosmetics, they're so proud of their makeup. It is beautiful, isn't it? The lab or the pride of the shirt is just beautiful. But a farmer, and he told us the kind of farm he'd been forced to leave back inside Shan State. And his paddy fields and his water oxen and his pigs and his chickens. He said, we're no longer farmers. We no longer have any land to farm. We're totally dependent on others. All for us dignified, independent people to be forced into dependency. But sometimes we feel very useless when we're there, but they find it comforting. He said, well, at least I'm glad that at last I've had a chance to tell the world. We can be their voice. Leaving Shan State and moving a bit further south to the plight of the Karen and the Kareni tribes, still on the eastern side of Burma. Crossing the river again, unofficially from Thailand into Burma, beautiful, but into the heart of darkness. The SPDC is carrying out large-scale military offences against its own civilians. They have sophisticated weapons, so when they shell the villages, of course, the jungle, buildings, wood, they just get up like tinder. gentle people, young carrying younger. But everything destroyed. I love kids, I always take pictures of kids, they always find somewhere to play. But the devastation is entire. Yes, the EC will destroy food stocks, so there's nothing left for survivors. They'll destroy livestock. Just in 1 month or 2 month period last year, in that one period alone, 30,000 Karen and 10,000 Shan were driven from their homes and forced to take what I can only call the long road to nowhere. Where do they go? Hiding in the jungle, and they can't even light fires. The fires, the smoke will be seen by SPDC, they'll come and be killed. Or to the refugee camps, where there are already hundreds of thousands crowded in those refugee camps along the Thai River border. Just come for a moment as they had to leave their homes on that long road to nowhere, carrying just what they could take. Goes on, that long road to nowhere. Resting on the long road to nowhere. Crossing rivers with a baby on your back. In the rainy season, rivers are swollen, you can drown with your baby on your back. Climbing out, soaking wet, can't light a fire, you remain wet, cold all night, for days on end. The face of anguish on the long road to nowhere. Train on minds. There are very brave mobile medical teams who will be with this space in the jungle, but it can't be there all the time. And the people whisper to say, I can't wait till Thursday to train on mine. Children. Goes on that long road to nowhere. Eventually, after a month on that long road to nowhere, that community arrives at a little safe haven near the Thai Burma border, and they're trying to build a new shelter. I love this picture. This little girl trying to help her family build a new house. It can't be home. They get home far behind. We sometimes ask the children if they will draw some of their memories of what happened back in their own land. These are some Kareni girls. This is across the border now in one of the camps in Thailand, drawing her memories of SPDC attacking the children at school and chasing up the hillside firing as they try to run away. The forced labor. We always told about forced labor. This boy remembers what forced labor was like for his family. Here the SPDC soldiers are forcing his elderly grandparents and his pregnant aunt to carry heavy loads. And we always hear this if people fall by the wayside, they get eaten and left for dead. The little boy is describing a story we've heard so many times. The burning villages, the Karini girl painting the execution of her parents. And the one says, oh, I'm very sad. One of our partners, one of our heroes, Dosei, a young man, what a privilege to support Dosei. He's one of the guys who would go across the border with the mobile medical teams to stay inside the jungle 10 months of the year with his people to be available, and if they are injured or ill, he has a 6-person mobile medical team, but they stay with the people. They have to be ready to run 3 minutes notice in the rainy season. This sleeping bag is always wet, it's constantly cold, so maybe that's a good thing. You can be prepared to run at 3 minutes' notice. And I have to hang my hammock low, for 4 reasons. To be below the bullets. If we're shelled, be above the shell bullets. It's slightly less cold near the ground, and it's less barbed to fall. But that guy was frightened when I saw him last time. He gave him the money he needed, and there was fear in his eyes. He said, I couldn't go in. I didn't pray. That's real courage. He goes in spite of his fear, and we know that if they are caught, they do have a fate worse than death. And one of his colleagues, just in the last 3 days, has been shot inside Shan's state. What heroes, what a privilege to help them. Dosei, one of our hero partners. Baby, given outside of Burma, Sasa, a young guy from the Chin Hill tribes, they're occupied, so they have the invidious situation of being occupied by SPDC troops in their villages. So they're always vulnerable to forced labour, to rape, to killings, to theft of land and livestock. Not like education on grade 10. No one can qualify to become a doctor. Sasa had a tremendous trajectory of studies to become a doctor. High school in Rangoon, pre-clinicals in India, had to learn Hindi and English. I met him in Armenia, studying medicine in his sixth language, and passionate to go back and help his people. Qualified last year with distinctions in medicine, surgery, and gynae, immediately went back to his people. They've now built a centre right on the border, India, Burma border, and he's training 340 community health workers. Fantastic. They've had no healthcare in those remote villages in Chin State at all. They're training 340 who will go back and take healthcare, mosquito nets, and knowledge to their spirituals. And the drug war? Sasa, that is our heroine Sasa, our heroine Sasa. When we visited last November, he only qualified in June, when we visited last November, the opening of this centre of health and hope, you were welcomed by this lovely candle, sort of procession, corridor up the mountain. But here, opening this new facility, only 5 months after qualifying, now training 340 community health workers. Fantastic. You also had the privilege of supporting two clinics on the Burma border. NOCAP is our partner there, wonderful girl. Here's our senior nurse, formidable, I would like to mix with her. She is fantastic. I love her. The medical supply, the kind of knowledge heart. And three lovely nurses, Nunu, Chin Chin, and Emily. They just qualified and they're going off to a very remote clinic, right on the border, no electricity, no one cons, to provide healthcare for Chin people right on the border in a very remote part of Chin State. Three young children. Crossing over the border, inside Chin State, carrying out much needed medical care, antenatal care. And as we leave, one of our heroes, Pastor Simon, touched him. Now he's been forced off his land. He lives in the refugee camps inside Burma. He happens to be a Christian. We work for people whatever their faith, but he happens to be a Christian. But I love this statement of dignity. And this is his fifth language. They call us a displaced people, but thank God we're not misplaced. They say they see no hope for our future, but thank God our future is as bright as the promises of God. They say the life of our people is a misery, but praise God, our life is a mystery. What they say is what they see, and what they see is temporal, but ours is eternal, because we put ourselves in the hands of the God we trust. Incredible resilience, incredible dignity. Very briefly, East Timor. You will know East Timor now, say whenever we are in Timor-Leste or East Timor, they express such gratitude for Australia and all you've done to help them over the very, very difficult years. You are much loved there. But, as you know, they had a very rough time at the hands of Indonesia. They've got their independence. But there's a large aftermath of destitution, suffering and malnutrition. Most of the aid organisations have now pulled out, but half the children are suffering from malnutrition. I love kids. But the diseases, the situation is dire. We have a wonderful partner there, High End Health, but they're not just operating a feeding centre. It's a pathbreaking programme for behaviour change. Now, when those families have gone to the hospital, the kids have been stabilised, then they come to High End Health Centre. And it's a wonderful place, again, of dignity. The families live there in very good quality surroundings. The children get really well nourished, so they're fully robust, fully able to return healthy little kids back to their communities. But while they're there, the parents and siblings learn how to use the food resources that are available, which they didn't know how to use, although are cultural taboos. So the philosophy is from the ground to the table. So while the families are there, they're going to learn how to grow appropriate plants, how to nurture them, how to prepare them, how to eat them, how to enjoy them, and then how to go back to their communities with healthy babies and tell their communities, not us telling their communities, them telling their communities, how to use the food resources that are available. And that, we hope, will eventually do away with the problem of malnutrition in East Timor. We're also working at Tara Island and the administration of East Timor, the only NGO there, visiting there early this year. What dignity. But behind that dignity, what poverty? So often the really poor people hide their poverty behind dignity. The needs are real. Suffering. You can help that. You can help that with health education, how to deal with skin disease. Rosaria is our wonderful partner there, our heroine, East Timorese. And seatbelts on quickly to Sudan. Sudan, as you will know, has suffered civil war for most of the years since independence. The situation became much worse in 1989 when the Islamist regime took power by military force and declared Islamic military jihad against all who opposed it. That's moderate Muslims as well as Christians and traditional believers. The weapons of jihad, threefold, formidable. Military offences against innocent civilians. The manipulation of aid, simultaneously. So every month, Khartoum would publish a list of airstrips open to UN Operation Lifeline Sudan and the forbidden airstrips. It would carry out its military offensives in the forbidden airstrips so no one could take aid to the victims or tell the world what it's doing. I read 30 times to those forbidden essays. Khartoum didn't love me very much. They gave me a prison sentence for illegal entry. I said, well, stop calling them no-go areas, they're legal, and I won't have to come legally. But the board's in your book, or while you do, I'll have to come. So I went 30 times, and the things we saw. Look at that young man, the blindness, which could have been easily prevented, that little one in the last stages of a trajectory of mal impression. The scorched earth policies, landing at little airstrips, again and again from horizon to horizon, smoke, villages burning, scorched earth policies. People come running up saying, thank God you've come. Come footing with us and see what the enemy's done. Come footing, they said, Sudan, and see the scorched earth policy. The slaughtered cattle, no food for survivors. Scorched earth policy, one of those pictures, Bar of Gazal, the western side, here southern Bunar, right across on the eastern side. Little lad, all that remains, the church in his village. There's now a peace agreement, Fajon, a referendum due in January, the secession possibly if they choose it for the South, a lot of concern that the North may instigate a new conflict because they don't want the South to secede. But Darfur erupted when the peace agreement was signed, and of course all the aid organisations and the media went to Darfur. You all heard about Darfur, the needs were real. But the rest of southern Sudan is a nightmare. Only 13% have immunisation. 1 in 7 months are down pregnancy in childbirth. 1 in 7 children die from the age of 5. Look at those babies like this smile. They always smile. Look at her hand. Leprosy. She shouldn't see. Khartoum denies the existence of leprosy. Well, here it is. What a privilege to hold that baby's hand. I happen to be a Franciscan, and one of St. Francis is saying that his pity weeps and turns away. Compassion weeps, puts out a hand. We can all weep and turn away. What a privilege to be able to put out, in some cases, a hand to help. Education is a real priority there. A lost generation of kids who had no schooling, there's a constant bombardment, teachers who only have primary education at best, and destroyed schools. Two little lads yearning for education, and all that remains of their school. This is up in Bar Gazal. But they want education. The Dinka chief at the height of the war gave us this very, very powerful and significant statement. He said, you, that's the British, the West, gave us education. That gives us the freedom to think for ourselves. You cannot give anyone a greater gift or greater freedom than that. What a profound statement. And how much they yearn for education. Well, we have to beware. If you join with the heart, you may find yourself doing strange things. Then you can know one of our volunteers. There's a teacher at Wellington College, one of our private schools. And she came out last year to that village up there where there were no schools. And she went back in the summer, and she got a Vodafone World Difference Award, and she's now spending all of this year developing a teacher training program in that remote part of Bar Gazal. There's Naomi, you can recognize her, she's Bob the Dinka. When we visited in February this year, at the airstrip, the kids from the school came to meet us with their bands, so proud of their bands and their uniform. And it's very difficult, culturally, to get an equal priority for girls to go to schools with digital boys. So the head teacher of the school, very important to encourage girls' education, calls it the girls' school, which boys meant it. The girls come and so do the boys. The girls proud of their dormitory. And the teacher training centre, as it was in February, now fully up operational, a lot of teachers gave the teacher training programme. And with the Nuba Mountains, a very precarious part of Sudan, and now as administration from the north, we work with the NRRTO, a joint Muslim-Christian organization. They've suffered so much in the war, and since the war, we said, what's your priority? They said, please help the widows. Widows in an after-war situation, their life is terrible. Nuba Mountains are harsh terrain, hard to get water. Widows need help. What a privilege. They're supporting free widow centers. This is down the southern part of Nuba Mountains, greeting us with such joy and such dignity. The widow's centre down there looks very simple on Australian standards. Sudanese is not bad, it's not wooden thatch, it's building, it's brick, it's got doors and windows. Inside, they've got an entrepreneurial exercise making pasta, which they'll sell at a local market. There's another centre up in the north of New Mountains, lab-working related. They will make such pride, they make a little flower beds, because they've been planting flowers like there in the desert of the New Mountains. And in this centre, they make jam and juice from local produce. But what a poignant gratitude. And finally, in the south, in Yeh, which was wiped out from the war, we have programs for orphans, more widows, primary health care, and clinics. One of the old orphanages, okay, dry season, not terribly comfy rainy season. The new one, let's build it. What matters is love and life. Here are the kids, they're loved. They've got a band. They've been dancing and singing. Little face of love. That's what it's all about. Life and love. Our wonderful nurse, Jocelyn. Another clinic which we opened. You won't see it. It's not called Heart, it's their clinic. An ABC will tell themselves. And our partner there wanted to help an agricultural program, just $12,500. With that money, he had a wonderful harvest. With that harvest, they were able to feed and get money for the orphanages, the healthcare clinics, had service money. They gave that to Women's Empowerment Program. They had a crop of sunflowers. With the sunflowers, they gave the seeds to mine injury victims. They signed an agreement for making soup with the sunflower seeds from the Women's Empowerment Program. And our partner, Bishop there, said, you know, the money from the mine injury victims and the Women's Empowerment will never appear in Heart's accounts. Wouldn't have happened if you don't give me the money for agriculture. What wonderful multiplier effect. And with the president of Southern Sudan, what's your priority is human rights. So many of my people are still enslaved in the north. I've got such a problem keeping the agenda of peace on the road. Will you please ask Khartoum to free the remaining slaves? The thing I constantly be on about with the British government, there are still thousands of women and children enslaved. You shouldn't have. In Sudan. I feel so passionate about this. I wrote a book on slavery. It's a year when you commemorated William Wilberforce's bicentenary. And many of the stories behind the statistics are actually people whom I've met, including those in Sudan, who've been today's slaves, and their voices speak for those we can't hear because they're still slaves. To leave Sudan, its future precarious as we move into the referendum. Hope, so despair. Very briefly, Nigeria, a lot of conflict, a lot of killings in Nigeria recently. Here's some of the violence in Plateau State, mass graves, university church in Dross, church in Bauchi. Young mum, she was attacked with a machete, but good things happening. Christian Institute training men and women for maternal and child health. Lovely smiles. They could be killed tomorrow. They smile today. St. Andrew's School, there 3 years ago, inside the school, rain season soaked to the skin. Now a new school, wonderful dynamic in teaching. The teaching aid, simple, but highly sophisticated. I don't understand it, but someone will teach me one day. But a wonderful dynamic teacher. Kids so proud of their school uniform. Here's a rural village in Kano State. They helped with the school there. They only had one teacher. It only cost £400 sterling to pay a teacher's salary. So they have 8 teachers and 168 kids in the school. The English grammar, how is it their main language? English grammar, Baku grammar. The plural of lady, box, and women, not self-evident. Since we have this in our primary schools, that's not right.
Thank you.
And our clinic there. And we leave Nigeria again, a very tense, volatile, challenging area. And our last destination, as I finish very quickly, Northern Uganda. Much of Uganda peaceful, prosperous, the North suffered horrendously at the hands of a rebel army with the strange name, the Lords of Resistance Army. It displaced people, it killed, it abducted 25,000 children and forced them to become child soldiers. Some of their stories are also in this book, They Tear Your Heart Out. The camps where people had to flee, 1,000 people a week died in camps because if they stayed in their villages, they'd be abducted and killed, and 95% had to live in these camps. Dry season, houses would ignite spontaneously. People would lose such possessions they bought. No shelter in the rain season. And in such a situation, so many problems. We went there and the MRO were active, other aid organisations pulled out for security reasons. What's your priority? These orphans. There's no one to look after other people's children. We managed to set up a centre, they cleared the ground, they made the buildings. Here it is, not Heart, it's their centre. Little kids came as jobs, little infants. Now they're 3.5 years old. They're lovely, healthy kids dancing a traditional African dance. The feisty foster mums, we managed to place a lot of them in foster mums. They just graduated from pre-primary with such pride and dignity. Our heroine there is Christine, the lady with the blue and white t-shirt in the second row. The teacher is one of our heroines. Kids who never been alive have been our privilege to be there. Josephine, is actually HIV positive. We're now turning that centre into a regional centre for holistic care for HIV positive children and their carers, being one of its kind in the region. That's what it's all about. Bringing love where they've been spared, hope where they've only been tragedy. Do you want to actually that photograph in February of this year, one of our little orphans there in Uganda. As we draw to conclusion, for me, and accountability, in 2009, all these programs of aid and advocacy, ones which I haven't even mentioned in Armenia and India, plus the poor costs of back at home in the UK, staff salaries, office accommodation, and overheads, were accomplished within a budget of £431,000. You don't need megabucks to make a difference. And it's always, I go back again and again to our partners. They're the heroes and heroines. They multiply the support we give in ways beyond anything you could ever imagine. The multiplier effect is phenomenal. The credit goes to them. They are true miracle workers. And finally, this sovereignty. There's sometimes when we look around the world, the needs are so legion. You don't know where to begin. And sometimes you almost feel paralyzed. You don't know where to begin, so you don't. Well, our little motto in heart, not in heart, is, okay, I cannot do everything, but I must not do nothing. And if together we all do something, then we really can share that privilege of making a difference. And it's wonderful to be down here in Australia, because setting up part of Australasia with my wonderful colleagues here. So thank you for letting me share just a little bit of the pain and the passion and that privilege of making a difference with some of the people in some of those forgotten parts of the world. Thank you so much, and thank you.
I think with a bit of help of St. Francis of Assisi, I think. The one he would have. And never read, of course. Thanks. We'll come to question discussion. Before we do, I should say thanks also to Gilbert and Turbin for the use of this facility tonight. Can I just ask the first question? Baroness Fox can come up
here. Yeah,
I might just stay here. When you spoke about a budget of about £431,000, which I guess is about $1 million Australian, which doesn't seem like a lot of money. What I did notice about your presentation was that with some aid groups in Australia, we seem to get a lot of lectures about climate change, a lot of lectures about social policy and about what we would be doing, but you seem to be focusing about just about what you do rather than what Western governments should do. So what's your relationship with Western governments? Do you get any aid at all? And what's your relationship with the United Nations? Do you get any aid at all? Or are you just sort of modern-day Sissy types just banging away in small countries?
Thank you very much for that question. Varies from government to government. One of the problems that we're trying to ask the British government for aid is that because all of our work is cross-border, they sometimes have some reservations about supporting cross-border aid, understandably, in terms of possibly of accountability. But we have proved now, I think, beyond any doubt, that our partners who work cross-border can provide accountability, even if it's not a form of spreadsheet and all the kind of things that big donor agencies want. Their accountability is superb. The evidence they give, the information they provide, the statistics, the photographic evidence, we have no doubt of what they actually are very responsible and very accountable. And I'm really pleased that in the last year, the British government has agreed, and on the floor of the House, they will support cross-border aid. So we hope we're moving that paradigm a little bit in that direction. And just one nice example where aid advocacy came together with the British government, when we briefly visited Chin State, there's so much more I could have said, but the people at Chin State have suffered a double whammy, not only in the violations of human rights, the attempted cultural genocide of the SBDC of their people, but half of Chin State is a bamboo state, and they do rely on bamboo. Every 50 years, very inconvenient, the bamboo flowers. When the bamboo flowers, the rats come, and the rats devour everything. So they were suffering a real devastation and food shortage. Now, this is where sometimes they get angry at the big aid organisations, because World Food Programme from Rangoon went up to Chin State, and I think probably compromised by Rangoon, apparently, I don't know why, but anyhow, they chose not to go to the bamboo areas. So they said there was no famine, there was no need for food in Shinseid. We knew there was. So we took a little heart team up to northeast India, and on the Indian-Chin border, we got the evidence of that famine. And we got BBC journalist with us, and she broadcast that, and that made World Food Programme change its tune, and he did admit there was a need for food relief. And when I asked a question in the House, Dibbit, equivalent of your Australian aid, Dibbit made a commitment that they would give £600,000 of food for famine relief for the peoples of Chin State, and they gave another £200,000 last year. That was an example where aid and advocacy could come together. Now, they didn't give it through heart, they gave it through Rangoon, but that's fine. It reached the people. So that's British government. The Czech government have actually given us money, and we're very grateful for that. And at the moment, because we're working so hard around a massive overstretch, we want to have a little bit more systematic approach to some other governments for support. But as far as the UN is concerned, from that, the final bit of your question, we do work for the UN doesn't. The UN does only go places with the permission of the sovereign government. And therefore, we will be where the UN is not, and therefore, they're not likely, I think, to be giving us money for where they're not working. So, as yet, we have nothing to do with
it. It does, talking about the British government, have you been involved at all with the Chagos Islands?
I can hear the question, so I don't need to repeat them.
You can repeat that question. Have you been involved with which islands?
Chagos Islands.
The Chagos Islands, which are where?
They are in the Indian Ocean, and the British government has been in quite a dispute over the last few years about moving all the people from Chagos Islands to Mauritius.
Can you hear the comments?
Yeah.
Fine, thank you. The answer to that is no. It doesn't mean they might not be interested in so being. We're very new. There's 4.5 of us. So under rather massive overstretch with the portfolio we currently have. But as we grow, I think we'd be very happy to consider looking at other countries which come with our remit, bearing in mind our remit, and I think it would fit, are people who are suffering various forms of oppression, persecution, human rights violations, not natural disaster, and who are, on the whole, off the radar screen of the international media. So if people would like to draw our attention to people to come within our remit, maybe give us some resources to go with it, then that we'd be very willing to consider expanding our portfolio. So the answer is not yet, but have you considered?
Can you just tell us a little bit about what you're planning to do in Australia?
Thank you, I'd be delighted to make it, and I was one of my colleagues who are elected representing
us.
Okay, well, I'm happy to answer it. I'd like to be a voice of the voice of their voices. But anyway, down here they have set up Heart Australasia, and I'm very delighted Dr. Martin Panton is our lead person. I worked with Martin. Many years, particularly in Burma. He was my lead person in Burma, and I first went to Burma crossing to the Karen people with Martin 16, 17 years ago. So we worked together for a long time, and Martin would love now to set up a branch of Heart Australasia. Here we've got a very strong board, and Roger Clifton is organised my programme here in Sydney. He's on our board, and we hope to get some of the passions for this way of making a difference going here in Australia, or Australasia, if it's like possible to go further in Australia. And I should say, I've been doing quite a lot of speaking in colleges and schools, and I find young people get really passionate. There's a huge amount to be tapped into in terms of young people. Since I've been speaking, in some schools and colleges, and I would love to engage some of the younger generation who are the future. A, with the human rights issues, because then we don't have, in fact, almost endemic feeling for justice and a passion for justice and an idealism. And I'd love to tap into that. So we'd like to get some young people involved. And just one example of maybe trying to do that, some of the places I've been speaking, we've been suggesting that if young people, maybe sort of senior school level, have to write extended essays, maybe of their international baccalaureate, or undergraduates. What we have in Britain, we have a lovely group of young volunteers who care passionately about these issues. We invite them, if they so wish, maybe to turn one of those extended essays, or if it's an undergraduate dissertation, into an article in one of the kind of areas where Heart is working, the kind of contextual research article. Then we can publish on our website, so they get their things published. But it gives us a wonderful resource, both of enthusiasm from young people, encouraging some of them to visit in some of the areas where appropriate, but also to engage with the human rights and justice issues.
Hang on, Ida and then Ellen. Yes, Ida?
Thank you so much for an inspiring talk. I was interested in your views on the jihad in Sudan. and I want to draw attention to your important book, The West, Islam and Islamism, in which you pose the question, is ideological Islam compatible with liberal democracy? Have you come any closer to an answer?
The question about the jihad in Sudan and the Baroness's book about whether ideological Islam is incompatible with is it compatible with liberal democracy? Yeah.
Well, I first began to be really concerned about international ideological and militant Islam in my work in countries such as Sudan, Nigeria, Indonesia, Alaska, Jihad, Sudan, Indonesia. And I began to sort of put things together, and with my colleague, Professor Mark, we then did quite a serious study of the growth of, I might say, militant or strategic or political Islam. And that's what is in this book. Go back to your first question, Sudan. Yes, Sudan has suffered civil war for most of the years since independence, but that situation, as I mentioned briefly, became dramatically worse in 1989 when a militant Islamist regime, explicitly self-avowedly Islamist, the National Islamic Front, took power by a military coup, immediately, explicitly declared Islamist military jihad against all who opposed it. So that included the modern Muslims as well as the Christians and traditional believers. Now, in advocacy, it's always important to try and hear both points of view. So if we're speaking for victims of regimes, always try and go and meet the leaders of the regimes. So I did go to Khartoum in 1993, and I met one of the leaders. I met Old Tarabi, who is an Islamist guru behind a lot of that development. I heard Old Bashir, President Old Bashir, claiming, celebrating the fourth anniversary of their coup. And we wrote our report. And in our report, we used quite explicitly the words which we'd heard and which we perceived to be the objective of what was going on in Sudan. We used the word jihad, but quite explicitly in the military sense. We all know it can have been struggle for a good life, but military jihad. And as we were guests of the government, we showed them our report before we left, because that's a courtesy to do that. And they agreed with our report. So they said it was quite explicitly jihad. They also said that the objectives, and this is in our report as well, they endorsed it, were the enforced Arabization of the African peoples and the enforced Islamization of the peoples who are not already Muslims. And you could see that being worked out in that war. And you could also be worked out in Darfur. That was more Arabization, because of course they're Muslims. But in this sub, it was explicitly Arabization and Islamization. And one of the weapons they used was also slavery, because that's a perfect way of carrying out your objectives. Take children, bring them up how you like. Abduct women, abuse them sexually, who change the genetic identity of their children. And this was very explicit, and we had that endorsed from people in Sudan and from Khartoum itself. So I'm not putting my own take on it, I'm reporting their assessment of what they were doing. So that was jihad there. As far as the broader issues are concerned, I've always prefaced that, of course, the vast majority of those 1.2 billion Muslims are peaceful, law-abiding, very hospitable people. And I know many very well. But they're not driving the international agenda at the moment of the spread of militant Islamism. And it's that worry of what is happening in the growth of strategic militant Islamism that drew me to write that book with my colleague and to share our concerns. And just very briefly, you can see that very much in Nigeria. A lot of what's going on in Nigeria at the moment, there's now Sharia law in 12 states, in association with a lot of conflict. In Britain, we also have Sharia law already, and that worries me, because the fundamentals of Sharia in any form of Sharia law, whichever strand of Islam, denies the fundamental values on which our liberal democracy is based. Inherently, it denies equality before the law between men and women, it denies freedom to choose and change religion, and equality before the law between Muslims and non-Muslims. Therefore, we have an incompatible legal system already in our country, and I think these issues we need to talk about openly, not confrontationally, but to share, because I think there are serious issues we do need to discuss and be open about, and not just worry about in secret.
For those listening on our podcast, the book The West, Islam and Islamism was published by Civitas, 2nd edition, 2006. Now,
the absurd situation that you mentioned of a huge chunk of the people of Burma being on the move from nowhere to nowhere. Is there any ideological explanation offered for this by the ruling party?
Thank you very much. Well, that ruling party, SPDC, well, it originally took power by military coup and it overthrew the well-known democracy leader, Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, and she's worked under House arrest ever since. They didn't have any official ideological justification. I mean, really, is a military junta clinging onto the military power. Insofar as you can read its agenda from what it is doing, it is probably adopting a policy of Burmanization as far as the ethnic nationalists are concerned, trying to destroy the culture and the independence of the ethnic nationals. Now, there are many of them. I've mentioned the Shan, Karen, Kareni, the eastern side, and the Chin, but there are also the Rohingya Muslim people, there are also the Mon, the Kachin, they're a whole lot, they've got almost 40%. But all of those have had this horrible choice they've had to make. Either they sign a kind of peace agreement, in which case they're occupied, that's what's happened to the Chin people, that's what happened to the Rohingya people, and then it's totally vulnerable, having hostile troops in every village to all the kind of human rights violations I mentioned, plus theft of land, theft of livestock, and being driven out. There are thousands of Rohingyas having a horrendous time in Bangladesh at the moment, in camps across the border in Bangladesh. There are lots of Chin in Mizoram state. And then on the eastern side, and on the Thai-Burma border, there are hundreds of thousands in exile in those states. Australia has given many hospitality to some of the Karen peoples. But, I mean, that's gracious, and they have a better quality of life in many ways. They're still exiled. Because exiles are poor, not exiled in their own land. So, insofar as you can assess what the ideology may be, apart from just power, it is perhaps trying to destroy the ethnic identities, individual cultural attributes, and to Burmanize, homogenize the whole of Burma. So, it's brutal power, basically. So,
can you comment on the millennium development goals? There was recently a meeting in New York where a number of world leaders and observers went to New York to talk about poverty, spending a lot of money to get there. These goals appear to be unmet by 2015, and probably getting worse for the being blamed on the global financial crisis. Given that you don't work for the United Nations, what's your
Well, my concern is very great and very acute. There's no way, as far as I see, those MDGs, Millennium Development Goals, are going to be achieved by this set date. You look at countries like Southern Sudan, and the worst health statistics in the world, but there's no reason why it should be like that. I'd like to know where all the aid does go. I'd like to know where the big bucks do go. The big organisations have mega millions of resources. Why are this Millennium Development Goals being met? And I must say, I have actually challenged our own government, where some of our own government money is going. They say a lot of money is going to Southern Sudan, but it's not anywhere where I am. So I would like to see far greater accountability, particularly the big donors and the big aid organisations. I'll show you one statistic, and I cannot give you, I don't have the confidence by name, but...
you're on the record.
I'm on the record, but I'm not giving the details.
Okay.
I don't mind generosity on the record, but I can't give the details because it's showing me incompetence. But a colleague of mine who's an expert in this area has asked you an analysis of what proportion of the budget of one of the really big aid organisations, I cannot say which one it is, competence, but what proportion actually got down to grassroots or sand level? Can you take it?
We have
10,
we have
5,
we're
getting other. Between 1 and 2. So that's the kind of thing, and that's the kind of thing I'd like to see far greater transparency, far greater accountability for where the big donors give their big bucks. Because I'm in Sudan and I see these things which I've shown you, which I should have seen. And the money certainly is not in many cases where it is most needed, and where the cases would be least likely to reach this MDG goals, Millennium Development Goals. I would like to see far greater challenging and accountability for where the big bucks are going.
Well, on that basis, where does the other 95-98% go?
Well, I can only speculate, but I know people who work in the world of big aid organisations tell me that this analysis rings true for them. You get big air-conditioned offices of all these organisations in New York and Kampala and Bangkok and all over the place. Air-conditioned land cruisers zooming around the place, large salaries. Bureaucracies, and to some extent, maybe self-perpetuating bureaucracies. And it breaks my heart. It's one of the reasons I would like to see the aid paradigm shift so much more to work out with foreign teams on the ground with the air-conditioned land cruisers, finding local people who are making a difference to their own people, giving them a helping hand, and may just say that the multiplier effect of that is phenomenal. The privilege of giving a speech at a conference at the Institute of Civil Engineers in London, and it's being addressed by all the big players, and they were all there. The Princess Royal was speaking, not before I spoke, and she didn't say to hear me, no problem there. But experientially armed to it, one of our senior military officers came, our army officers, who has a remit of the British Army, been working with NGOs, and he said, I would love to see an analysis of heart multiplier effect. It's so different from so many aid organisations. As I said, the way people work with multiplier is a little weaker than based on anything you can imagine. So I might see a much greater shift in the aid paradigm towards working through local partners, being accountable, helping them make a difference in their own people. And that way, I think, it'll be much quicker getting to Millennium Development Goals.
Question down here, yes.
I have heard that the 95% is used to maintain asset bases such that people can ensure that their programs are maintained from year to year. But my question was, how do you affect that paradigm change in moving towards grassroots programs, and how would you see the most effective way that people in this room who donate to those kinds of charities could affect that change?
Thank you very much indeed. I mean, thank you for that observation at the beginning, so I don't think that is where all that money probably does go. As far as how we can shift the aid paradigm, we're just through, I think, identifying organisations like Heart, who really genuinely work through local partners. Now, you know, it brings its own challenges, because a lot of these local partners, when you're working in really remote areas, have never seen a spreadsheet in their mind. So if you're trying to think of accountability in terms of the big donor organisations who will be giving money in the West, I might see more of a bridge building, too, in terms of appropriate criteria of accountability as well. Not always a huge spreadsheet and a massive bureaucracy. And to get money out of the European Union, I mean, I'll take one of my top ends of the year where he's put in the forms. You know, we don't go down that route because we haven't got the time or sources broadly out there making the difference. So I think, look at those organisations which are genuinely working with local partners and not spending megabucks on their own offices and their own staff salaries and everything else. Identify them and give them a helping hand to help people make the difference. And we do it Heart. And join Heart. We'd love to hear more.
There's a question down the back that I missed before. I think there was. Yes.
Baroness, thank you for everything. I'm interested in the refugee stations in places like Shan. Who sponsors them and who works there? And I know that you go there, but who works there and who sponsors them and who pays for it?
Thank you very much for that question, because I feel passionately about that. The partner we work with for the Shan, for example, is SWAN, Shan Women's Action Network. They're lovely. I mean, they're very impressive. Ladies who run that, and they have obviously a particular concern for maternal child health and maternal and child mortality, and they're our primary partner, and they do work cross-border inside trans state, and they're the ones who are helping to fund the kind of programs that we visit in there. So again, you find local partners who are working to help the local people, and we fund them. Or Joe Say, for example, that heroic young guy who's across the border in the jungle 10 months out of the year, could be killed any day. But his passion was to be with the people all the time. Because there are some other organisations that come and go, but as the mining director said, we can't wait till Thursday to tread on the mine. Dozier's passion and his colleagues is to be there in the jungle with the people all the time. However uncomfortable and horrendous their circumstances are, he'll be alongside them with his team. And what a privilege to find someone like that. So that, I think, is an answer to your question. Funding for people who are on location with their own people. Does it make sense?
To a degree, but I'm interested. I saw the visuals of that refugee station, and that's housed by a country. Which country, and how do you get the money to actually put the houses up and so forth?
That was inside Shan State.
That was inside?
It was inside Shan State, yeah. And so, and obviously, the Shan peoples themselves, they're very resourceful, they're very resilient, they're very courageous people, and they're trying to make the best of a bad job inside their own country. But at that refugee camp, there was inside Shan State. Some people arrived just while we were there who'd just been driven off from their village, arriving, so it's going to be a very overcrowded refugee camp that is based in their own country. And one of the schools which we supported across the border inside Karen State, Martin knows Rainbow very well, we supported schools inside Karen State. Just recently, we've heard very tragically, they've been shelled and they've had to be across the border into Thailand. So it's a nightmare scenario. Needs every bit of help you can get.
And we're getting to the end. There's a question here, and then, yes, Rick. Yeah.
Has Heart attempted any aid program in the Gaza area?
The question, have you attempted any aid program in the Gaza actually don't care about the Gaza area, but because many people are working there. I mean, a friend of mine who works in medical aid for Palestine, there are a lot of aid organisations there, so our value added there, being as small as we are, would be relatively little. Because it's a tragic area, everyone cares about it passionately, but there are people already doing such work as they can there, and as our value added there where other people are, would not be particularly significant. We could be more used, but no difference.
Just a final question. I noticed when you made your comments on Burma, you're fairly strong on Burma, and I think you're correct on Burma. But as you would well know, I mean, in a sense, the best way to make a difference in Burma is to achieve regime change, if that were possible. I mean, why do you feel that you can make these quite strong statements about corrupt governments, as they are corrupt governments? That's different to the stance of other organisations who tend to walk around these kind of issues rather than confront them. Do you feel confronting these issues helps or does it make any difference?
Well, thank you. I think it probably varies from country to country. In Burma, we actually helped to host a coalition of NGOs and advocacy organisations inside the UK. We work with Project Burma, Burma Action, and a lot of the advocacy organisations, which might be my aid and advocacy. Bring the two together. And where we can, it's so important to partner, not to compete. I get that question in the aid world too. So when the aid organisations compete, we've got to partner. I mean, the needs out there are legion, the work is a few. So we do have state advocacy, and I speak regularly in the British Parliament on the Burma issue. So we do the advocacy parliamentary side of things, and one of the things which we're currently working with a lot of other governments at the moment is trying to get the UN to do an official committee of inquiry into that SPDC regime in Burma. So that level of advocacy goes on in the political arena alongside the grassroots level. But sometimes your advocacy in the political arena is that much more powerful because you've been on the ground and you can tell it how it is. And that gives a substance and a passion to the advocacy rather than just reading the news reports and speaking at second hand on the evils that regime is carrying out.
Thanks
so much.
So, Mr. Griffin was, I've known of Baroness Cox's work for quite some time. I've heard her speak once before and I've always been impressed by her practicality, and I've worked out tonight what explains it. I didn't realise until Roger Tilton reminded me that your background initially was nursing, and then you became an academic, and then you became a politician. And I think you're a very practical person who speaks in very practical ways and achieves your organisation hard, obviously achieves a lot, but not a lot of money, and that's very impressive. So you've given us a fine account today of what you're on about, what you hope for Heart Australasia, what Heart's doing elsewhere, but also a quite honest account of the problems of aid and the problems of governments in some instances where aid is necessary. So well done today, no doubt you'll be on the advocacy platform in the future. We may see you back here at Sydney Institute, but tonight, well done and good luck in Australia. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.